Hi, my name is Pat Roach, and I am sure one grateful Al-Anon today. Oh, Rachel, we love you. Well, I wish you could look at yourself. By the way, there's over 1,000 here, honey, now that you're finished. You're pretty good looking out there. Yeah. I laughed because I was wearing pastel today, and I laughed Maria's comments about the first time she came to an AFG and all the pastel ladies. I think it's such a wonderful comment to make about us sometimes. It's an Easter egg hunt, you know. And, you know, I'm sure people think, what have I gotten myself into here, you know? Oh, well, Carrie, thank you so much for inviting me to do this. It's probably the nicest kind of thing that could ever happen to me in this program. I have a whole lot of affection and most certainly respect for Carrie, as we all do, and also for her very fine father and her son. And many of us know that these people have been through a tough year, the kind of year that some of us have to go through with alcoholism. And they've just demonstrated the strength and the courage. It comes from a family of survivors, by the way, so that's not new for her. But I'm so grateful that not just me, but of course all of us get to walk. If we aren't having tragedy in our life, and somebody is, somebody is, and we get to walk with that and one more time be reminded of the just awesome gifts we get here, the gifts of courage. I don't know any place in the world where there's 1,000 people out here and every one of us has a story of courage and pain. And we're just fine, aren't we? The chairman, host, and hostess are sitting down here, Sandy and Gary, and they gave me the biggest galdern basket of stuff I've ever seen in my life. Oh, I had people coming in and robbing it last night, actually. I don't blame them. Whoa. So see if you can get to be a speaker here sometime. I've been grinning so much and laughing and crying so much this week, and I mean, this is as good as it can get. Oh, the speakers have been wonderful. And last night, I'm wearing a daisy. So Kathy threw me a daisy. And if you didn't see that show last night, oh, my God, when they were doing the Age of Aquarius, it was my living room. That was just so funny. Oh, my God. And later they said something about one of them wanted to bring a roach clip up there or something. And somebody said no. And I said, you could have used that bong we had in our house. I didn't know it was a bong. I didn't know what a bong was. I just knew there was this real pretty kind of a glass thing that the kids... And every once in a while it would get some dark stains on it. And I didn't know... Oh, dear. That was absolutely... Oh, gosh, I'm just exhausted with laughter. And that's what I mean, all the laughter in the midst of all the pain. It's just, I have a special place in my heart for Alateen. Because when I had been in the program about a month, I really knew what I was doing. And I'm from Oceanside, which is about 30 miles north of San Diego. And that was March, I came into Al-Anon on St. Patrick's Day of 1970, which I like to say is God's example of a sense of humor, because I married a member of the CIA, you know, the Catholic Irish alcoholic. So it's a nice little ironic twist that's the night I went to Al-Anon. But I've been coming about a month, and there was an old lady in our town, which a few of you knew, Millie Horkum, and she's been gone a lot of years now, but Millie claims she didn't drive. I honestly don't to this day know if that's true, but because she said she didn't drive, she'd get somebody to drive her places. And she talked me into driving her down to the San Diego Intergroup, which was just being formed at that time. And the ladies were sitting around, and there was one man there. And they were putting together bylaws or something stupid. I mean, I had problems at home, you know. And what is all this about? Now, I want to tell you, I was about, well, actually, it was more than, about a month now, and that's about right. And I was already sponsoring an Alateen group. That'll thrill all the Alateens here to know. What good hands you were in. And one of the, you know, my kids wouldn't go to Alateen, and actually some of them needed something besides Alateen, but I didn't really know that yet. And so I went with her, and they were putting together the San Diego Intergroup. And there was a little arguing going on. There's a whole lot of people in this room that have participated in Al-Anon service at those place kinds of places. And, you know, some of us really change personalities when we get in those. And those pretty little blue-haired ladies that were so sweet during the meetings at home. Huh. And I sat there, and I was kind of, it scared me a little bit, to tell you the truth, because I hadn't heard that kind of arguing in Al-Anon. And besides, I wasn't, you know, I didn't need to learn much from you. I'd actually come to help you out. And the truth. So that's why I was there. You know, I went with Millie because there may be something I could help with. But I hadn't heard you argue. And there was they really got going. And one of the women stopped everybody and said, you know, we're not putting principles about personalities. We need to slow down here. And they all said the Serenity Prayer. And then they started again. And they didn't argue. And I know that many of us, when we first come into Al-Anon, we sit and listen to those steps and those traditions, and we hear them. And if you're like I was, that makes some sense. Yeah, that's a nice theory. Well, and it changed something for me. Because I watched it happen, and I had an experience that I've never forgotten, obviously. I'm talking to you about it today. And it had to do with not just thinking about those steps and traditions, but watching it work. And then I volunteered to become the Alateen coordinator for San Diego County. They never had one before, so they didn't have anybody to compare me to, you know. Can't do too much wrong. And that particular path took me in some different directions later on that was to change my life as well. The thing is that God in His wisdom seemed to know that I was supposed to get that lesson, and I do believe that if I'll just stay still enough and listen, there's just a lesson all the time from a higher power that I sometimes don't understand, but I don't even need to. And I came home that day, and one of our daughters, who was 14, and I didn't know it then, she was plotting her path to AA, developing her story. And she wanted to do what a lot of 14-year-olds want to do. She wanted to go play with the 21-year-olds. And and the thing is that it was the poor kid. She had this crazy household. We have five kids. My husband had come into AA shortly before then and is still there. And my mother, who was an alcoholic, had moved in with us. And that was kind of fun, actually. She provided a light touch, I'll tell you for sure. And but I had gotten in the habit, because it seemed to me that this child who had a big mouth and just seemed to test, you know, my husband and I have talked about this. When she was about, I mean, she wasn't even 18 months old. She was just kind of walking and getting around. And the kids were supposed to be out playing for some reason. And we said, you're going back outside. And she did it. But she did it at her own pace, all the while just looking at us. Stepping slowly out. Do you picture it? You know what I'm talking about. She'd go outside, but by God, she was going to do it her way. And we laugh about that because little did we know. But that's what was developing in there. And because that gave a lot of problems in our household, and because her dad was drinking most of those years, there was often a really major skirmish between those two. And because that was happening, I got this off-balance thing that I hear a lot in Al-Anon, where I figured I had to be extra easy on her. Because, listen to the people that relate. I always hear that. Because, gosh, she had to put up with this over here, so I had to go easier on her. So the kid didn't have one responsible parent. She had one that was going to yell at her and be angry, and the other who was not even going to take the trouble to discipline her when she needed it. That's my sickness. Because it became very, very important for me to keep peace in that house. But she was yelling at me about wanting to go to whatever, and I didn't say the same thing to her I'd always said. And again, this was right after I'd been to that intergroup meeting, and she screamed, "I hate you," at me. And I hadn't had a kid do that. And I said, "It's more important for me to like myself than it is for you to like me." That was a lot of years ago, and I've gotten to pass that on a lot. And I'm so grateful for that, because, of course, she laughs now. She says, "Boy, I knew things changed in that house." And she says, "Mom went into neutral," I mean, which is funny. You know, that's a nice place to be. We talk about detachment and releasing with love, but, you know, when you want to shift gears out of reverse, you have to go through neutral. I like neutral today. God, it's heavenly and neutral. I don't go anywhere, of course. I just sit still, but that's a good thing for me, because I was busy. You know, some of us come in here, and my good friend from Oklahoma, some of you know her, Nell, and she talks about about rocking and plucking. She's sitting in a rocking chair, plucking the chenille off her robe, and in her Oklahoma accent, saying she's feeling precious and pitiful. Oh, don't you just love the picture? Oh, I wasn't precious and pitiful, and I did not want you to get that impression. I did not want you to feel sorry for me, and I most certainly was not pitiful, because I could do it all. And I was. And my oldest daughter's here today. Kitty, she's down here somewhere. Where are you? There she is. And, you know, being the oldest daughter in a family, an alcoholic family of five kids, I think you're just destined for Al-Anon, don't you? Whatever else happens, you're going to end up here, hopefully. And my husband is here somewhere in this vast crowd. There he is. And I would say my qualifier, but I've got so many of them that I don't like to single anyone out, you know. I'm very lucky. I have lots of them. Some of you only get one or two. I don't know what I was saying. No, I was organized, and I was raising these five kids, and he was not shaping up. And I didn't just get involved in trying to control his drinking. I was very busy trying to control his anger. And he talks about that himself when he gives a talk. He remembers being just pissed off at the age of four. He's not sure why. You know, he just knows he was just pissed off. And I didn't get raised that way. I got raised really with a lot of love and support and a lot of good times, because my mom was one of those happy little alcoholics. Just kind of, God, she loved life. And, you know, alcoholism takes that away from people, too. Didn't ever completely remove it from her. But, you know, that's that delightful childhood I had in a little town called Las Gatas, California. And my grandfather, her father, was the town drunk in a little town called Blooming Prairie, Minnesota. One time I went there with Bonnie. A lot of you know Bonnie. We were both up at Minneapolis or something. And we drove down there trying to find my roots. I thought maybe I could find my grandfather's grave. Nobody seemed to know what happened to him. And, you know, we've been in this program a long time, and I don't... if he's a town drunk, he's a town drunk. I know that. But there's less than 2,000 people in Blooming Prairie, Minnesota. There still are less than 2,000 people there. And we couldn't figure out how to go about locating anybody. So we went to the library and asked the librarian about things, you know, where might we locate in maybe his grave. And she said, "Well, was he Lutheran or Catholic?" And I said, "Oh, well, I guess maybe he was Methodist." You know, I didn't know. And she said, "Oh, I don't know where they buried those." You know, it's just so funny, because we went to a pool hall, and I asked about, because it was, you know, his name was Johnson, and there's every other person in Minnesota's named Johnson. And there were a bunch of old men sitting around a table, and I said his name, and I just said it real loud. You know, I really hope somebody here remembers Earl Johnson, and all these old heads came up like, you know, it really was funny. And Bonnie and I both decided, yeah, they knew him, but they weren't going to talk about him. And it's one of those moments where we realize what freedom we get in this program. Because I said no. You know, I used to keep those secrets. We all did, most of us. Whatever the secret might be, I did grow up keeping secrets. That was part of my family. My dad was a very loving man, kind of quiet. He got real depressed before he died. and his depression, I'm sure, was directly connected to the progressing alcoholism in my mother. I had an older sister and a grandmother who were all very much part of my life in a small town where everybody knew me and everybody loved me, and I believe they ought to, you know. It's a nice way to grow up. Mom's drinking wasn't a big problem to me particularly, and I found out after I got here why that is, because she was a periodic alcoholic. There are people that are that. I didn't know what that was about, but I did know that she would be months and months and months just a great, happy-go-lucky, 4'10", little funny woman, full of health, funny lady. You know, she'd drop everything to go chase the fire truck, and then she would have been doing that when she died if she wasn't on a walker, you know. And life was fun, no discipline. And the house was pretty messy. I mean, sometimes we couldn't find a clean plate everywhere by the end. So, you know, some of those things weren't so good, but basically it was okay. And then every once in a while, she'd just go through this spell of a couple, 3 weeks of being just maudlin drunk. But she didn't do the kind of things that are so awful. In that small town when I was a kid, we still didn't have, get this, dial phones. I'm 70, so you know that would have been whatever year that was. And 70 and a half, they told me, when I have to start taking my IRA out next month. Wait a minute, I'm not that old. I can't be. Time to take it out? You know, they make you do that. But anyway, kind of got my attention. God, I got to pay attention here to getting old. But she would maybe late at night make a phone call, and she'd pick up the phone, and you had to talk to the operator. And she'd say, "I'd like to talk to Mabel." And the operator would say, "Pauline, have a cup of coffee and get off the phone. Mabel's asleep." You know, you didn't. So we didn't have any secrets. I mean, you don't really have secrets, you know. But I did learn I was supposed to keep stuff a secret. And we did learn to try to find her bottles, and she hid them in weird places, like in the garden, in the horseradish patch. And she had a lot of imagination, this lady. And so I did learn that stuff, and I learned to use the morning after guilt. Ah, it's a great trick if you get to develop it. You know, you get real good timing. Just get it right. And they'll give you anything or do anything if you catch it just right. You probably know this, Rachel. And I got to carry those things on into my marriage. Manipulating. Learning to feel better than somebody else, because by the time I went on to college and met my husband, her drinking had progressed, and I could be scolding her and feeling superior. Learning to use an alcoholic's behavior to excuse mine. And I did that in college completely stupidly. I mean, I didn't do very well in college. I'd been a straight-A student in high school, but college was more fun. And it was 1946, and the war had ended, and there were a whole lot of GIs. And there's probably a few people here old enough to know, remember that. Not too many, but a few. Now, you know, when you've been raised in a small town and you come out, you're 18 years old, and all these men. And they've been defending my life, they told me. And nobody lied to me yet, so I partied. Oh, I had a wonderful time in college. So wonderful, I flunked out in my senior year. But I had already found a life project anyway, so it didn't matter. And God knew that was a worthwhile purpose. I mean, you know, I didn't need to graduate. I just had my term paper right in my house. I married him. And he was very happy about that. He was very glad to have somebody tending to all these things in his life that needed help. Because he got nervous and upset and angry and drank too much when things went wrong, like the checkbook didn't balance. You know, or the wrong thing was served for dinner. Like all of us know, it goes on with alcoholism and somebody's struggling with their own inner soul. And knowing little by little they're eroding their own self, their own spirit with alcohol, and everybody in this room has watched that happen. And it's a tragic thing. I didn't see it as tragic. I saw it as I was just full of judgment. You know, that's a bad person, or he's not, or I'm not doing my job. That a lot of it was. I must not be filling the role here. And so I developed all these. I got some of these patterns before I came into the marriage. I was a natural to just keep right on doing them. And he used to think, he said, "You know, you do so well with your mother's drinking, you can really help me with mine." He didn't deny having a drinking problem. No one at San Jose State would ever deny that my husband had a drinking problem. It was impossible. He was not a quiet little drunk that just sat in the corner and called somebody once in a while. He was loud and noisy and full of hell, and I loved it. He got a lot of trouble on the surface. I got to controlling his, trying to control his anger and his drinking, and then I got busy controlling his bladder. You got to keep some dignity in the family. And he's the kind of person that if nature called, he'd just answer, you know, wherever he was. Sometimes, you know, we'd all stop at a gas station and everybody else would go in the restrooms and he'd, maybe the gas pump would be fine. And at parties, you know, I got so real good at knowing just whatever he was drinking, I could figure out when he's going to need to do that, and I'd steer him in the right direction. And, you know, we developed some pretty amazing skills on our way to Al-Anon, don't we? A couple times I missed, and, the potted plant got it or something. And so my life was this constant figuring out how to keep him happy, how to keep our house happy, peace at any price. I don't need to understand. Maybe I do. Maybe I do understand, but, you know, looking back, I was a selfish, kind of self-willed person when I married him, although I'd learned to manipulate people. And I became more and more a person who simply made decisions completely based on somebody else's reactions. And I didn't get that way overnight. You've all heard, I bet, the analogy of putting a frog in water. If you put a frog in really hot boiling water, it's going to jump right back out again. But if you put it in a nice, kind of comfortably warm, and then you just turn the heat up little by little, that frog's just going to say, oh, I can adjust to this. I can, you know. And they'll die. It's a good analogy. That's what happened to me. It wasn't like an overnight jump. But for 20 years we were married before we got to this program. And during that time, I just made one little adjustment after another. And the most damaging to me was the way I mothered my children. They tell me I wasn't all bad, and I don't think I was either, because I really got a kick out of those kids. Crazy, nutty kids, I'll tell you. Wonderful kids. But, you know, in spite of the fact that I got such a kick out of them, and I wanted to be with them, and I was a lot as far as going to the things they did, my heart and my emotions weren't tied up in them as much as I would have wished. And I got raised with a whole lot of attention and people that paid attention to how I was feeling. And my oldest daughter's here. She's just a great gal, I'll tell you. She's such a dear to have in my life. And she was the one, being the oldest, that I think I felt the worst about later when I took my own inventory. And she's, you know, she's cool. I don't know. She just doesn't seem to walk around worrying about that, but she's an Al-Anon too, and that helps. But you know, it had to do with leaving her with way too much responsibility, and leaving her with kids that were fighting with each other, and then she would be the bad guy, and so her own siblings didn't like her, so she didn't have anybody, and it's really hard. And I think that part of that little show last night was about that, about the mother and a daughter. That was a wonderful show. I can't get over it. I can't quit talking about it. I won't for weeks. But the mother-daughter, yeah, I'll applaud any time. You know, the healing that can go on where we can forgive each other and we can forgive ourselves. But that was the most damage I did to myself. And that was why it was so important when I came back from that intergroup meeting and knew that I was saying something different to that daughter when I said I needed to like myself. And I knew I was going to do it differently, and I did. It was slow, but I knew I wanted that feeling more. I didn't want to stop there. And I had to bounce around a lot. I got a sponsor. I went to Al-Anon, by the way, because Cliff's sponsor told me I needed it, which I didn't because I'd been a psychology major. I'll pause while everybody moans. He was a drama major. Made in heaven. All the drama majors loved me. I just listened to all that hysterical stuff they did and fixed them. Didn't know what I was doing, of course, but, I don't know where I was going with that. Doesn't matter. I'm just so funny to be just free. Who cares, you know? Got no secrets up here. might get boring, but, you know, who cares? But I know I'm raising these kids, and I'm trying to manage him. And he had said he thought I could help him with his drinking because I helped my mother. See, what I do is my dad would call and say, your mother's drinking again, come talk to her. I'd go out and talk to her, and she'd stop drinking for a while, for a few months. And I felt like I just had a special gift. He thought so, too. I mean, you know, it looked that way. And I came in here, and you told me that she was periodic, and she probably would have stopped anyway. And I'm bound to hit it right every now and then, and so I had this sense of power. And I like to equate alcoholics to slot machines. You know, they'll pay off just often enough to keep us... Put those damn quarters in, you know. I like quarter slot machines. And I sit at a slot machine. That's when it all came to me one time. We were up in Reno. And that mine isn't paying off much, and the one next to me was, you know. And I thought, When that guy leaves, I think I'll move over to the other slot machine. It's paying off. Then I think, no, I've got too much invested in this one. Oh, God. Jack talked last night about being loyal. You know, that was me. In fact, one time I went to a marriage counselor by myself, and and she said, "What's the first character trait that comes to your mind that you like about yourself?" I said, "Loyalty." And you know, I was glad I was anything. I was loyal, never realizing that you can get kind of sick being loyal. You know, it's time to stop beating the dead horse. The kids were growing up, and this was in the 60s. That's why that, oh, God, that last night, I just, oh. And they were discovering some ways to make their life more manageable. Some of them were, some weren't. But, you know, when you have five kids and your house is full of parties, we had parties. And I was giving piano lessons by this time. I did not know how to do that, but I did it anyway. And apparently it wasn't too bad, because when I got here, I was given 37 piano lessons a week. That's a lot of work. And managing to do all the things. And then I was helping my husband. He's a speech teacher and drama teacher. I was helping him with his work. Because he'd go off on these speech tournaments with these kids on weekends. And I had to go. Because, God, he couldn't stay sober on a weekend. And my mother came to live with us after my father died. That's Cliff had invited her. And... that was great. I loved having her there. And everybody loved Grandma. She was on a walker because she'd broken her hip. She didn't remember how it happened. She thought it was odd that it had never hurt. And she loved it there. Everybody loved her. And we had parties going all the time around piano lessons and whatever. And I was trying to run a dignified piano studio in the front of my house. And I always had to remember to get something off the piano. My husband had gone to Mexico to surf or something and had purchased a Mexican art object, a carved man's hand with a particular finger extended. If you're in the back of the room, you can tell what I'm talking about. And it was, he said that was his statement to the world and his philosophy of life, and he was, by God, going to put it on my piano. And I had lost such track of my choices by then. And this just stuns me still to look back. I honestly believed I had to leave it there. But of course I couldn't have it sitting there with these kids coming and going. So I would sneak it out while I was teaching and then get it back. And you know, I just hope against hope that I could get it back when lessons ended before he came in. And I know a lot of people have this absolute insanity when you look back. But I really felt trapped then that I didn't have choices. And I did get him to go to a psychiatrist and he got antabuse. And the psychiatrist died, which... So there was no more interviews, so I would take my... And I made sacrifices. When I came into this program, and I'd been here about a month, Millie gave me a great big letter M and said, you've joined the Varsity Martyr Squad. That was hurt. But I love that today. So I'd put my small child in my station wagon, and I would drive to Tijuana. And I'd purchase interviews. I'd go to four or five different stores because I didn't want anybody to realize how much I was buying. And it's against the law to bring those things back across the border. So I'd buy a piñata, and I'd That's the pinata with anabus. And I'd sit at that border thinking, you know, this is illegal, and boy, it's a federal offense, and if they catch me, I'll have to go to federal prison, and my child will have to go into a shelter, and then he'll know how much I've done for him. You know? He didn't appreciate it, actually. I had a hell of a time getting those interviews down him. But I was trying to run a dignified piano studio and keep track of all these children, and after school there'd be all these teachers in the middle of my house at the kitchen and dining room area making margaritas, getting them on wrong. You know, they'd have three blenders and noisy, and the damn finger I had to get rid of every day. And then out the back door, some interesting things were going on with hashish sales. Because, you know, it's handy for a teenager to make a few bucks that way. And some of the kids were trying these things out. I didn't know what it was. I knew that sometimes they smelled musty. And I knew that sometimes they got very busy. That's when they had little white pills with crosses on them. And I learned to take advantage of any of those situations. If they were really smelling musty, they were just so easy to get along with. Everything was beautiful. Cool, it was cool. Daisies were flying. And out would come that pretty strange green-looking thing that I thought was an odd vase, which actually was a bong. And, or whatever, I don't know what it was called. And my little mother was supposed to, I would run her to the physical therapist because she was supposed to get exercises, and she'd get them and come home and do all 50 at once and couldn't walk for a month. She was alcoholic. She had discovered pills, and she was a periodic alcoholic still, but she was a daily pill head because, of course, she had some nice pills to go with that. She was in charge of all these people. And so I have a candid camera scene that I will describe to you because I must never forget it, and I don't think I will. And I think most of us do, where we have a moment where we can picture every detail. And this particular one was in my living room, and I was standing there about 7 at night, and I was finished teaching. And the kids and all their friends had eaten all the food. They ate a lot when they smelled musty. And, well, at first I thought it was because all the neighborhood kids were coming in and taking the food while I was teaching. And they were, but that wasn't all there was to it, I learned later. And the kids, you know, everything was screwed up. They were unhappy. Each one was trying to do what they could for the family. One kid was... had discovered hallucinogenics and was seeing little flashing things and leaping around, and my husband's drinking had progressed, as it does, and the unhappiness in my children and my confusion about where I belong there, and I can just picture every one of them and what they were doing, trying to help. And I won't go into all that today because it's, I don't have time, but I have to. But it's good for me to remember, and what I want to say here is that the vision of that living room with my five children and a few others, and they all looked alike anyway, you know, I couldn't tell who was mine anymore. Like last night, you know, God, they all just look alike, they're all just doing what they did and smelling musty. And the progression of alcoholism, and I wasn't understanding it, and my mother's, I had responsibility for her. But my favorite part of this is my dog. And his name was Siesta. Siesta had been hit in the car, by a car. He liked to drink martinis, by the way. And he did. You put your glass down, he'd slurp it right out of there. My favorite dog. And his pelvic bone was broken, and he couldn't lift his rear end up to do what he was supposed to do in the backyard. He needed help. And I remember looking at all those people and realizing that I had failed. That I somehow wasn't doing my job. What am I doing wrong? And I remember kind of talking to God about that. Because I'm grateful that I was given a loving God, no denomination, just a loving God. And I grew up and I didn't lose track of that. I just felt like it was my, I wasn't listening. And I looked at all those people and I thought, I'm supposed to be doing something here and I don't know what it is. But my dog would bark and I knew I had to take him out in the backyard and hold his tail up while he did what he did in the backyard because that was my job and that was something I could do, wasn't it? When Cliff went into AA one more time, no big deal. He'd been in and out for 5 years. It didn't mean anything to me. In fact, it was a lot easier when he drank than when he didn't. Not that he was all that much pleasure when he drank, But he, of course, didn't have good sobriety, you know. And Bill Blake came into our lives, and Bill began taping this AFG when it started. And he lost money for the first few years, but Bill loved Al-Anon. And some of you knew Bill. And he came, paid his own hotel bill, you know, and that's the kind of people we have in our lives. Bill said I should go to Al-Anon. I told him what I told you. I didn't need to. I was a psych major. Then on St. Patrick's Day of 1970, he said, I checked Al-Anon out and they need your help. And Bill had figured me out, thank God, and I loved that man, and he died a bunch of years ago, but... And I came into Al-Anon, and you let me help you, didn't I tell you? I went running down there. I sponsored Alateen. And while sponsoring Alateen, and I got a sponsor, of course, and I began working my own steps and recognizing and beginning, along with the pain of taking the fifth step, Rachel, it's okay, you don't die. And we'll get you later when you get in Al-Anon. That'll be fun. I know what she means, though, you know. Who wants to look at us? Good grief. We've been the ones saving the world here. And you know, you guys let me help you, so to speak. You really did. You just didn't tell me what an arrogant, smug, self-righteous SOB I was. And you let me help you, and I did. And because of that, I got to do all these things in service. Al-Anon service has been the answer to my dilemma. especially the kind of service that goes with world service and the structure. And Carrie has these people here today up here in front because these... And it was Millie who said, you know, being a convention person and talking or working on this or that are wonderful and they're part of Al-Anon, but the real structure of Al-Anon is in the World Service structure. And I got into that, thank God, because there is where I learned that it's okay to screw up. What a gift. It was there that I learned that I could mess up if I wanted to and everybody just applauds, you know. What a gift. That got me back to school. And I went back and finished and went on to graduate school. And the reason I was motivated to do that was because in the Alateens, there was a girl who was being molested by her sober stepfather. And there wasn't much help around for people back then. And I knew that. And I did a lot of work in that field as a volunteer person. So I decided to take a deep breath and go do that. When I was going to graduate school, it was my kids and my Al-Anons who absolutely... kept me going to class. There were times I didn't want to go. I thought I feel so stupid. I'm older than everybody else. But they just say, you're not going to miss class. You're going to go. And so I did it. And it was really through the strength of this program and the people in this program believing in me. And consequently, the work I do today has a great deal to do with what I learned from those Alateens. And I'm very grateful for that because I get to serve in a different way in my community. And because of my Al-Anon and I had those traditions first, I know the difference between traditions and what we do in our therapy with those families. But all of that's because I walked through Al-Anon doors. And a lot of times I was scared. And if I think that I know there's new people here, and I know that I used to think that I would get over the fear if I just came to enough meetings, I'd stop feeling afraid. Didn't work for me that much. Mainly, I'd do something while I was afraid, anyway. And then I felt better. And the simplest things were what worked for me. It's just changing my lines and going to lots of meetings and working in Al-Anon service because that's where I got my strength. And that's where you've continued to give that to me. Our latest Al-Anon book has a page, the one that's Having Had a Spiritual Awakening. There's a page in there, 20-something, about the monarch butterflies. You've probably read it. It talks about the monarch butterflies and they make their migration and it takes 3 generations of butterflies to get there. And you know, I think of us because that's what we do. We come in here, we give what we give, and we pass it on, and we do it right, we hope, and we give it back, and then we trust that it's going to go on, and we just trust. We trust the process. I'm very grateful and my time is up. That's hard. This room is filled with ghosts and angels of Winnie E. and Elsa C. and June Andrus and the people who've come before who gave us strength and courage and light and the light touch, helped us not stay so serious. And that won't ever leave us because we keep passing it on. There's a sentence out of one of Ernest Hemingway's books. He's not conference approved. He was just a drunk. And he says that the world breaks all of us, but some of us become stronger in the broken places. And that's what you've given me. I was broken by alcoholism, and you've given me strength in my broken places. I sure thank you for that.
Super big gulp cup. And of course, I'm a little kid, so I'm like, soda. So there I go with my little legs, and I run over there, and I'm looking around to see if my mom's there, because I'm not really supposed to have soda, because it makes me bounce off the walls. So I look around, and I see, like, my mom's not there. So I'm like, I'm going to take a big swig. So I grab the cup, and I take, like, the biggest drink in the world. And all of a sudden, I realize it's not soda. It's gross. So my cheeks are, like, full of this stuff. And I open the lid really fast. I'm like, rotten soda, what's this? And I open it, and it looks like pee. And I'm like, mom drinks pee. That's all I could think of, is that my mom drinks pee. And I spit it everywhere. And here comes my mom walking around the corner, and she's like, that's what you get, that's not soda. And I'm like thinking, I'm like, mom drinks tea. And she's like, she's looking at me, and she's like, of course I have this gross look on my face, so that's nasty. So it was beer, if you haven't figured it out yet. And it was gross. So that's the first time I realized that my mom drank beer. So after that incident happened, I never drank out of a big gold cup, and I, it never, crossed my mind again that my mom, you know, I was never like, my mom's an alcoholic, because I'm 3 years old, and I don't know words that big yet. So I'm just going on with my days or whatever, and I'm probably, I had to have been about 7, and I come home, and this is my next, understanding of alcohol, that I didn't even, get it yet. You guys will understand later. But anyways, so I get home, and my mom, has this huge black eye. And I'm, looking at her, and I'm like, Mom, what's wrong? I'm getting home from school. And she's like, she had tears in her eyes, and she's like, well, I went to play softball today and with your dad, and a ball hit me in the eye. And I was thinking, why didn't you take me to play softball? That's really mean, you know? Because I was, you know, and I started, yelling at my mom. I was like, I want to play softball. I had to go to school and learn all day, and you get to go have fun, and da-da-da. And so I'm, yelling at my mom, and she has a black eye. So what happened was, is it wasn't until I was about 15 years old that my mom finally told me what happened. What happened was my dad's doctor, in the eye, and gave her the biggest black eye that I've ever seen in my life. And when she told me, I, started crying. I was like, oh, my gosh. Because I remember I was yelling at her, and my dad had punched my mom in the face. And it wasn't too long after that that my parents started fighting, a lot when I was around 7. And I remember one time, I heard cluttering and banging in the room. And, so here I am, little Miss Gadget chick. And I go and I unscrew the doorknob because I'm trying to get in my parents' room and it's locked. And I unscrew the doorknob and the doorknob falls off or something. Me and my brother were trying to look in and the doorknob fell off. And then what happened was we locked my parents in the room. I'm not a real mechanical person, but so the doorknob's off and my parents were locked in the room and my mom's crying because they were just fighting. But it ended up being a pretty funny story afterwards because they were locked in and they had to go out the window and then I got in trouble and whatever, but it calms the tension. So anyways, it was shortly after that that my parents decided that they needed to separate, and I moved to Hawaii with my dad and my mom stayed in California. And my mom would always tell me it was my dad's fault because my parents are both alcoholics, so that didn't work out too well in our household. But my mom would blame my dad, and my dad just wouldn't say anything because he didn't really care. And I didn't think of principles about places because I was going to Hawaii, you know. I'm late, Mom, I'm going to Hawaii. I don't care if Dad hits you. So I boned out to Hawaii. And that's when I started understanding what an alcoholic was, because I didn't understand why my dad hit my mom. I just thought she was being dumb or something. I didn't understand it was alcohol or anything. And Hawaii was the first place I actually, saw alcohol and saw its effects. And my dad got drunk, every night. I was like, I lived there from when I was 8 to when I was 12, and I literally raised myself. My dad would go to the barbecues next door, down the street. Maybe he'd go to the field because he was in the army, or he would go to rehab. He left us at home alone for 2 months when he went to rehab, and I had to have been about 10 years old. So, I don't know. I'm a pretty well-rounded person, though, as you can see. But, anyways, my dad, he, like, left us. My dad was, like, a pizza driver on the side, and we'd go to ride in the car, and, like, the little Sagram 7 bottles would roll out, and we'd stop, and I'd be like, Dad, weren't you driving pizza around last night? He'd be like, yeah, don't look at us, you know, throw them out the window, whatever. And it's like, all I could think of is my dad's driving around delivering pizzas really drunk. My dad's going here really drunk. My dad was always, always really, really drunk. And that's before I had the program, really. I didn't know the do's and don'ts, so I would, like, hide the alcohol, and then, like, he'd get mad. So I would hide more, and he'd get mad. But my dad was, like, the calm, like, be nice drunk, you know? Like, when he was drunk, that was the time to get money. So he'd be sitting down, and he'd be like, Dad, $10. He's like, all right, you know, go away. And I was like, yeah, $10. So, you know, started giving him the brewskis, you know. But I don't know. He's pretty calm about it, though. I mean, I even still to this day, a lot of Alateens have, like, parents that are sober and they're in the program. My parents are practicing alcoholics, and they practice every day, all day. So they're pretty good at it because they practice a lot. So, I don't know. My dad is a wonderful guy now, though. But anyways, what happened was my dad was moving to Texas, and there's no way I was moving to Texas, or I'd have, like, 5 kids by now. Sorry if you're from Texas. But but I wasn't going to Texas. So so I moved back to California with my mom, and that's when I started going to Alateen. And what had originally happened was I went to SCAC, and I hated it. I thought that it sucked. There was a bunch of old people running around with squirt guns, and I hated it. I was 12 years old. So I'm like, this program's dumb, you know? And how I got into it is my aunt was the sponsor of a meeting, and she would take me, and I'd be like, okay, this is lame, and I would, like, go play out in the hallway and stuff. So, and then I went to SCAC, and I just thought it was even lamer. So I didn't go back to SCAC the next year, but then the next year I went back to SCAC. Woo! I saw lots of fine guys. I was going back. So like probably about 87% of the other Alateens, I decided Alateen was cool because there's lots of guys my age, you know. I was at about that age where they looked good. So I started actually getting involved in the program because the guy that I liked was involved in the program. So I'm like, I want to impress this guy and be involved in the program too. So, so I started going to everything, and that's when it actually started working for me, is because I started, like, being there. I was actually, like, involved in the program, and I went to everything, and I did everything. I'll be honest with you. I haven't made it past the fourth step because me making an inventory of myself just doesn't work out for me. Like, first of all, I don't understand why I have to make an inventory of myself because my parents are screwed up. And also, I have these days where I think I'm pretty almost perfect, so those wouldn't be good days to do it either. So, I'm struggling on that one, but I try. So, anyway, so that's about as far as I've gotten my journey, but one of these days, I'm thinking maybe when I take my transition to Al-Anon, I'll be a little better, because then I'll be more mature, supposedly. So, we'll see, but regardless, I'm still in the program, and the program has been a lot for me. Whether it be through, like, the commitments that I've made or the friends that I've made, it's just, like, everything all in one. It's really changed my life. And my mom and dad, as I said, are still practicing alcoholics. My dad's really proud of me, and my mom tells me I go to Alateen because then they tell me that she's screwed up so that like, that means that I'm not screwed up. So, like, to make you understand, it's like she's saying that I'm really screwed up, so I have to come to the program, so you guys told me it's her. But I don't know. She tells me these things, and I know that they're not true. And, you know, without the program, then a lot of the things that she tells me, I would think were true. And that's one thing that the program's done for me, is that I've learned to ignore the lesser things in life, like my mom's dumb little comments. And she's always trying to hurt my feelings, and I got the kind of mom that compares herself to me and says, like, whether it's looks or, like, what I'm doing with my job or whatever, my mom is constantly, constantly comparing herself to me. And I don't know, the program just makes me realize that my mom is sick. She is really sick, and I can't help her. She's got to help herself. And when my mom tells me that I go to Alateen because I'm screwed up, and that's what you guys tell me, is that she's screwed up, then I know that that's not true. And even if it was, cool, because I like it. She's screwed up, you know? And I don't know. Like, Alateen's done a lot for me that way. And now today, like, I'm still the same person that I brought up, and I don't know. It's like maturity, and it's the program that's gotten me this far in life. And I can go home, and I can see my mom drink, and I can get mad at her, you know, but I can hold it in and not say anything. And it's like a lot of things that happened in my house today are still pathetic, and my mom acts like a four-year-old. She acts like the little kid that I have to watch. But you know what? It doesn't even bug me, because that's how my life has always been, and that's what it's like what I expect, and I can't make my mom change. And that's what I've got. That's what I've come to realize. Like, when I used to hide my dad's alcohol, I'm not going to hide my mom's alcohol, you know? And my mom isn't the give-me-money kind of alcoholic either. She's mean. I'm serious. She's mean. She is really, like, mentally abusive. And, you know, I can't change her. And that's, like, a sad thing in my life. But the program and all of you people that are here, all 987 or how many ever I'm talking in front of, I don't know. You guys all, like, help me out. And there's a sponsor at a meeting that I go to. She, like, you know how you look at somebody and you're just like, wow, I wish my mom was like that. That's what I do, like, with her. It's like, I see her and I'm just thinking, like, she talks about her kids and all I can think is, wow, I wish my mom was like that. But my mom's not. And if my mom was, then I wouldn't have the program and I wouldn't have all of you. And that would be sad and stuff. So, I don't know, I'm done sharing, but definitely the joy is in the journey. And one more thing is, my youth pastor told me when I was younger that, like, he said he was going over a dip, and like, when your car's going downhill, it's going the fastest, and a police officer, I got in trouble for that once, but anyways. A police officer was, like, clocking him as he was going downhill, and he got his speed when he was going fastest. But when he started going back uphill and he wasn't going fast anymore, that's not when he got the ticket. He got it when he was going the fastest. And, like, the whole point of that is that everyone notices when you're going downhill, but when you're coming back up, no one really cares. It's like, I don't know, it's a good analogy. And whenever I think about that, I mean, that was, like, years ago, and I don't remember anything I learned in church. And that's one thing that I do remember, and that's what I think about, is, like, when I'm going downhill, everyone's noticing, and when I'm coming uphill, no one is. And it's like, you're the only person who knows when you're going uphill. And maybe your uphill is downhill for somebody else, but that doesn't matter, because it's your uphill. So, the joy's in the journey. Drive slow.